It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Well, welcome to Quantum number 38. And as we enter to Easter, we're going to think about some of the things that are going on in the world from a Christian perspective. And I do want to begin with this extraordinary account by Martin Bashir of the BBC of a meeting between the Pope and warring factions within Sudan.
Well, the atmosphere inside the meeting room was already quite emotional because it was the final gathering at an event that one official described as miraculous. Up until the beginning, the Vice President Riek Machar, there were doubts about whether he was even going to turn up, but he did. The Pope had delivered some remarks, and then he stood up from where he'd been speaking, moved in front of the desk, and concentrating his eyes on President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar, he said, "As a brother, I ask you to remain in peace. I ask you from my heart." He was pleading with them to cease fighting, to stop the bloodshed of the last 5 years where 400,000 civilians have lost their lives. And then without saying any more, this 82-year-old Pope walked towards President Kiir, and assisted by an aide, he knelt down and kissed his feet. And Kiir's facial expression, I was about 15 metres away, conveyed a mixture of shock and humility. And when the Pope moved on to Vice President Machar...
Now, without going into all the details of the conflict, because there is conflict in South Sudan, there is conflict in North Sudan, and it's an area of great poverty and an area of great conflict. And we remember our Christian brothers and sisters there, and we remember, obviously, the many Muslims there as well. But that meeting struck me, or at least the account of it. Whatever you think of Pope Francis, and there's good and bad sides to him, that imploring for peace, it may be a bit idealistic, but it's something that we long for. I think within the world that we live in, the problems of human sinfulness, the kind of worship of ourselves, and the corruption, and I think the violence and the warfare in different ways, we long for peace. And I think ultimately that does only come through the cross. Now, speaking of the cross, let's go to Notre Dame and, of course, the tragic burning of the cathedral there. It's still standing in terms of its main towers, but the steeple has come down and the hundreds of year old roof has been burnt down. And it's led to a lot of comment and some quite extraordinary reactions. I've put up a link to at least one post. Let's just deal with some of the main issues, or some of the points that arise out of that. One of the things that is completely astonishing, I think, to many people is that already more than 1 billion euros has been pledged, including a couple of billionaires who've pledged about 500 million euros. Now, first of all, I find it astounding that people have that amount of money to give away, and secondly, that they're willing to spend it on a church building. But Notre Dame is a quite extraordinary building. But even so, should we be spending that amount of money? That's a question that John Humphreys asked the Archbishop of York, and he was very defensive of it. I'm not so convinced at all. I do wonder if we've forgotten the words of Jesus that destroy this temple, speaking about the Jerusalem temple. He said, "After 3 days I will raise it again." He was actually speaking about his body, and this Easter that is what we remember. And I do wonder a little bit that, beautiful as Notre Dame is, and beautiful as these other cathedrals are, I do wonder what messages we're trying to get over with them. Another thing that we need to deal with, it does appear that, as though this was an accident caused as the renovations were taking place. But there were those immediately who wanted to say it was Islamic terrorism, and several people sent me a copy of an article from the Telegraph about gas canisters being found in a Islamic terrorist car and so on. But this was an article from 3 years ago, and we need to be really careful not to feed rumour. Now, having said that, we mustn't take away from the fact that in the past couple of years, 785, there have been 785 attacks on churches in France. Most of them are presumed to be not by militant atheists, but by Islamists. I understand that there were four churches burned in Germany. And I remember when I was in the past month, and I remember when I was down in Bradford speaking to a taxi driver who told me that two churches had been burned in his city. This was a couple of years ago. And he said, but nobody reported it because they didn't want to inflame tensions. So I don't think Notre Dame is a result of Islamist terrorism, and you have to be really careful not to start saying things like that. But I do think that there is a level of underreporting. Now, speaking of reporting, it was incredible to me how much the BBC were able to speak about Notre Dame and not mention Jesus, not mention what it was built for. And that's, of course, in tune with the secularist ethos of those who run our country. I saw one person tweeting that Notre Dame should be restored as a museum of art and architecture and history without the legacy of child rape and supernatural delusion. Do you know this? I don't think that our culture is capable of building something like Notre Dame. We're going to try and build something to the glory of man. Notre Dame was not built to the glory of man. It was built for the glory of God. Whatever one thinks about having church buildings like that, that's what it was built for. And I just don't think our culture is capable of building anything like that. But yes, it was and is a sad thing to see, a great and magnificent building. One last thing maybe to say on it. I was going to say a great and magnificent building being destroyed. But one last thing to say on it is just simply this. As I see the photographs, as I watch that steeple collapsing, somehow it did seem to me that it's indicative, it's symbolic of the collapse of Western civilization, built upon Christianity, but being destroyed by neglect, being burnt up by fires of secularism and Islamism and the other isms, communism and so on, the other isms, materialism, that are overwhelming the Christian heritage of Western Europe. Yes, I think it's symbolic. Let's move over to Indonesia just now, which is the world's third largest democracy with 193 million, and they have just been voting. And it looks as though the current president, Joko Widodo, is about to be re-elected in a vote with his main rival, the former military leader, Prabowo, I think is how we pronounce it. I think this the thing about this election is, apart from its just sheer size, 193 million votes to be collected from 17,000 islands, is the way that Indonesia has been moving in religious terms. Now, it is the world's largest Islamic country, and it has been relatively tolerant to Christians. We've had an Indonesian family, I've had in fact two Indonesian families worshipping in our own church here in Dundee. And it has been relatively open for Christians, but both candidates this time have really played to the Islamists. And that is profoundly worrying and profoundly concerning. So please do pray for our brothers and sisters in Indonesia. And then let's move on to South Korea, where there is a ban in South Korea on abortion. And that's been ruled unconstitutional by the court, and say the law must be changed by the end of 2020. South Korea is one of the few industrialized stroke developed countries in the world to criminalize abortion. And I think this is actually quite sad. First of all, the fact that a court does that. Surely it's for politicians to do something. When did courts, I mean, we're moving more and more towards this where unelected courts are determining what public policy should be. The job of courts shouldn't be to make the laws, it should be to ensure that the laws are enforced. And I think this is a sad day for South Korea. Well, let's return again to Australia. We've moved from France to Indonesia to South Korea. We go now to Australia, where Israel Folau, who is a Christian, he's the Australian's best rugby player, has in effect just been fired by Rugby Australia. This is what the head of that, Raylene Castellan, had to say about it.
At its core, this is an issue of the responsibilities of an employee that an employee owes to their employer and the commitments they make to their employer to abide by the employer's policies and procedures and adhere to their values. Following the events of last year, Israel was warned formally and repeatedly about the expectations of him as a Wallaby and a Waratahs player with regards to social media use, and he has failed to meet those contractual obligations. It was made clear to Israel in writing. And
now notice what she says. Rugby is a sport that continually works to unite people regardless of their race, religion, gender or sexuality. All people are welcome to be part of the rugby family. Except it seems Israel Folau. Except it seems because he's removed for tweeting in response to a question, a Bible verse, which amongst other things, adulterers and drunkards and idolaters and so on, condemns homosexuals. Now, what Folau says, what he believes, is the standard biblical position that all human beings, no matter who they are, deserve hell unless they come and seek and find the mercy of Christ. Now, I actually don't think he's discriminating against or attacking homosexuals. Whether he is wise to have said that in the current climate or not, as some have argued, is not really the issue here. The issue here is the inconsistency and the hypocrisy and the intolerance of sport. And we're going to look at some of other intolerances as well. Now, the boss talked about contractual obligations. Well, what are those? Does he have a contractual obligation? Is it part of his job as a rugby player not to quote Bible verses? Is that really the case? What about somebody like Sonny Bill Williams, who is a famous All Black who converted to Islam, who regularly quotes from the Quran, who's in conversation with a mufti who says that gays are worse than animals? Is it okay for him to stay on? Why is he not banned? Or what about Carmichael Hunt, another player who plays for the Waratahs, which is Israel Folau's team, who's arrested for drug use? It's okay for him to play on, but not for quoting the Bible. I think of the hypocrisy involved here in the CEO of Qantas, Alan Joyce, saying, if you're unhappy with a company that's involved with this, then you won't be able to bank and you won't be able to fly anywhere because the big corporations are backing all this, the LGBT agenda, which is usually expressed in terms of rights. What about we come to this country and an England player from Fiji, I believe, or from one of the islands there, Billy Vunipola, who tweeted in support of Israel Folau. Now, he didn't do it in a condemnatory way, but he's been condemned. And we have this rather bizarre thing where he was condemned, he was booed by the fans, the hysteria, the witch hunt that's being worked up by the media and others. I think one of the best commentaries on this comes from Matthew Paris, who's gay, who's an atheist, and he wrote this fabulous article in the Times in which he says this: many of the world's major religions believe homosexuality is a mortal sin. Most of Africa does. So do many, many Christian churches and sects. If an only moderately well-known sportsman may not signify his assent to somebody else's expression of that opinion, then I begin to worry about our overall commitment to free speech. First, they came for the homophobes. And if you think That's a bit strong, and good for Matthew Paris for saying that. What about the hypocrisy of the media in this, and the hypocrisy of rugby? So, Billy Vonipola is dropped as a commentator by Channel 4 for its rugby. But Stuart Barnes, who is a rugby commentator and a Times journalist, listen to what he had to say about this. "I always loathed the way those Islanders formed a circle post-match and gave their praises to what I regard as a fabrication." He goes on, "But I'm a child of the Enlightenment, fortunate enough to have the benefit of a reasonable education." Now, do you hear what he's saying? He's saying that these Islanders, these Pacific Islanders, that they are ignorant. He actually loathes them. He loathes them for their faith and for their religion. It's the ultimate in colonialism. It's the new colonialism. Of course it's racist, these poor, ignorant Islanders. And it's certainly discriminatory against deeply held religious beliefs. Is he going to be reprimanded by the Times? No, of course not. Is he going to be removed from rugby commentary? No, of course not. Because racism and being hate speech towards Christianity, I loathe it. That's fine. But quoting the Bible, that's not fine. You know, even saying people going to hell. Did not Donald Tusk, the president of the European Commission, say that Brexiteers were reserved a special place in hell? Was not that repeated by Guy Verhofstadt? So if these people are talking about people going to hell, why is that okay? But not for Israel Folau, who has never indicated that he wishes anyone any harm. Well, let's stay with intolerance and let's stay with Australia and let's go to Barry Humphries and Dame Edna. Now, for those of you who don't know, Barry Humphries is the comedian stroke actor behind the character Dame Edna Everidge, where he dresses up as a woman and has played this character for many years. The Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which I think is the biggest comedy festival in the world, was actually part of it, was started by him, and part of it is actually named after him. And the award that's named after him, its Barry Award, has been removed. Why? Because of these alleged transphobic views.
Today, now, we covered some very controversial comments from Australian icon Barry Humphries. He's branded, as we mentioned yesterday, transgender celebrity Caitlyn Jenner, quote, a publicity-seeking ratbag. Now, he says he backs feminist Jermaine Greer, who said transgender women are not real women. The man best known for playing Dame Edna Everidge went on to say Caitlyn is, quote, a mutilated man. Now, we were very disturbed by that comment, Carlotta.
Well, I was watching and I got very cranky with the television and I thought I'd love to have been there. I've got a couple of things to say. Mm-hmm. Jermaine Greer is another story. I could have written things about her that I knew years ago, but I didn't. She knows about them. And she's turned out a very big disappointment in my books. And as for Barry, I can't believe he came out with this statement. He doesn't really understand transgenders. He's a female impersonator. That is what Dame Edna is. And all I can say is I never got mutilated. I've been totally and beautifully manicured. Oh, and unlike Barry, my Tupperware doesn't leak.
You are not allowed to deny the truth of transgenderism. You are not allowed to offend in comedy. Now, I thought the justification for all the blasphemy and all the attacks on Christianity by comedians, I thought the justification for that was, well, we're allowed to offend anyone. No, you're not. You dare not offend transgender. That's intolerance. You want to see intolerance in another way? Scientific American has just published an article saying why we should all use they-them pronouns. Does this have anything to do with science? No. It has a lot to do with being American and the current culture in America. But don't call it science. Again, it's intolerance. Please don't think of liberalism as some kind of peaceful means of protest. No, 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 no. There's a woman from Villanova University who is giving a lecture, which she's written about and boasted about, Reimagining Activism as Combative. In this presentation, Dr. Billy Murray will challenge the violence, non-violence binary that limits our understanding of activist practices. Drawing on examples from her fieldwork with anti-fascist activists, i.e. Antifa, she will argue that we should reimagine activism as combative. Such an expanded understanding will allow us to better discern the efficacy and ethics of combative tactics and how they work in concert with traditional non-violent activism. Here is a lecture being held in an American university by a lecturer encouraging protesters and telling them why and how they should be violent. Yet we ban a player, a rugby player, we ban him from playing his sport because he puts a text from the Bible on his Instagram, and we allow people to lecture people on how to be violent in their protests. It's a crazy, crazy world. Let's stick with the craziness just a little bit. Let's look at the intolerance of business. I mean, every business has to get on board. As the director of Quanta has said, we all have to come on board or we're all going to suffer. And the cooperative, I'm a member of the cooperative here in the United Kingdom. It's, I think, in a crowded field, this is my crazy thing of the week. They have decided to introduce a new gender-neutral gingerbread person. No more gingerbread men. No, it's going to be a gingerbread person. And it's going to be non-gender specific, as if they ever were. And this is their statement. Inclusion and diversity lie at the heart of the co-op's values, and we're looking to create a character that can be used to celebrate different occasions and will appeal to all our customers. Struth. We mentioned last week Roger Scruton and the intolerance of government. He was completely set up, but the Conservative government here couldn't care less. They got rid of him. He said something that was deemed to have been Islamophobic. It almost certainly was not. You can listen to his account of it on the Quillette podcast, in which there's a fascinating interview. A couple of other things. As amazed to see China opening a new airport to the south of Beijing, which is going to be the world's largest single building airport terminal. And I was watching a video about it. Utterly incredible. Again, China seems to be at the forefront of technology and of development. And it is amazing what they are able to do. But speaking of amazing, of course, we cannot leave without mentioning Easter. Now, as per usual, every Easter there are lots of programs, most of which miss the real meaning of Easter, some of which get it. There's usually a wonderful editorial in The Spectator, as there is this year, which seems to get Christianity a whole lot better than many Christians. And in that regard, there was a report that 46% of people in Britain who said they were Christians did not believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead for the forgiveness of sins. So these are people who say that they are Christians. Now, listen to this question and answer that is given about this.
Well, let me bring in some of the beliefs, though, that go along with that encounter, Joe. Do you think you can call yourself a Christian and not believe that Jesus died and rose again for your sins?
I think it's quite a complicated statement, and what we don't know is where people struggle with the statement. So is it the fact that Jesus even lived and therefore died? Is it the fact, the much more outlandish claim, that he was resurrected on the third day? Mm. Is it that process was in order for forgiveness to somehow come about?
Yeah.
And is it because that we are all flawed and fallible? What we don't know is where the sticking point is.
Now, sadly, and I say sadly because the lady who was speaking, Jo, was from the Evangelical Alliance, and she was asked a straight and direct question. Can you call yourself a Christian if you do not believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead for the forgiveness of sins? Now, I am certain that Jo believes that a Christian is somebody who believes that. And when you believe that, the simplest thing to do when you're asked a question like that is give a straight and direct answer. Why not just say, no, you're not a Christian. If you don't believe that Christ died, if you don't believe in the cross, if you don't believe in the resurrection, you're not a Christian. Now, I to give you another example of that, there's a Church of Scotland in Edinburgh, Morningside Parish Church, where the minister, as a former moderator of the church, tweeted out, and the denomination as such publicised it as well, that its Easter Friday services were to be held by Richard Holloway, the former Bishop of Edinburgh. So what, you say, if you don't know Richard Holloway? Richard Holloway is no longer Christian. He may be an atheist. He certainly describes himself as an agnostic. He does not believe in Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible. He does not believe that Jesus died on the cross for our sins. He does not believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And yet here he is being invited to lead the worship. So I made a comment about that on Twitter and got this kind of the passive-aggressive thing from the minister saying, God bless you and we continue to pray for you. Yeah, but who are you praying to? Because if you're praying to a Jesus who didn't rise from the dead, then we are of all people to be pitied, as Paul says. I'm sorry, I'm just fed up with this nonsense from religious people who waffle on about Jesus, 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 and they don't know him. They know nothing about him. We're in a world which is so filled with war and trouble and confusion and mess and intolerance, and we have religious leaders unable to communicate Christ because they don't know Christ. Little wonder that almost half of professing Christians in Britain say that it's not necessary to believe that Jesus died for your sins or rose from the dead in order to be a Christian. Yes, it is. That's the point of being a Christian. That's the greatest news in the world. I'm going to leave you, well, with a couple of quotes. No, I'm going to leave you with a song and a quote. Aretha Franklin, a number of years ago in the 1970s, did a concert, Amazing Grace, and they have found the film of that, and it is the album is absolutely astonishing, and the film already looks, I've seen a couple of clips, it looks as though it's going to be completely amazing, and she sings Amazing Grace. I have no doubt at all she got it. You got it. You listen to the emotion in that voice. That's what grace is, not the waffle that we get. But when that film comes out, I'm desperate to go and see it. And my quote of the week, by the way, thanks again for listening. If you wish to support Quantum, and thanks to those of you who do, please do get in touch. I'll be putting out a private podcast this coming week as well, just to let you know what's happening to all those who support it. You can go to the Podbean fundraiser to do that. But the quote of the week comes from Michael Green, the English evangelist who died recently, and I thought about him. I thought about this Easter. The resurrection is the place to begin if you're looking for a satisfying faith on which to base your life. Do not waste a lot of time investigating every religion under the sun. Examine the evidence for Jesus instead. If he is risen, you need look no further. Christ is risen. It is only in the light of that glorious fact that we do not despair, and that everything in this world can begin to make sense or has the potential for being redeemed. It is my hope. It is your only hope. May you know the risen Christ this Easter. See you next week. God bless. See?